All right. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Siege of Woolley City Council. Today is December 7th, 2022. It is 6 p.m., and I am calling this meeting to order. Will you please stand with me to say the flag salute? Thank you.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right. We'll go through a quick recall, and then we have special guests and a presentation coming our way. So I'll begin with Councilman Owen.
Present.
Councilman McGoffin.
Present.
Councilwoman Diamond.
Present.
Councilman Burns.
Present.
Councilwoman Kestie.
Present.
Councilman Allen.
Present.
And online, and because I don't have it up on my screen, do we have Councilman Lavaca out there? We do not, and he may be joining us a little later. He asked to Zoom in tonight. He is traveling. So, all right, we will move on. So it is my pleasure. So at a SCOG meeting, there was this wonderful presentation from these three individuals, Jenna, Daryl, and Will, whom are going to be coming up and sharing also with you. The situation that we're looking at with Seattle City Light and the concerns that they have and what they are asking as far as the relicensure. And I'm sure that some of you have read in the paper some of what's going on. And I'd really love to have Daryl and Jenna and Will fill in the blanks so that we know how that impacts us and what we might be able to do to help move this process along. So, all right. This is Daryl Hamburg, by the way.
I just formally introduce myself. I'm Daryl Hamburg. I am the chairman of the board for the Skagit County Dyke District Partnership, which is the five districts on the Skagit Delta. I'm here with Will Hona, who is the attorney for Skagit County, dealing with water. And excuse me, I'm fighting some allergies, so if you can bear with me. And then Jennifer Ebel, who is with the Skagit County Dyke District or Dyke Drainage Consortium. So she deals with the drainage side. I deal with the flood side. Today, we're here to talk to you about Seattle City Light. They're going through a relicensing process right now. It's a 50-year license, and we're looking at an opportunity to maybe possibly get a placeholder for more storage in the dam through this next license. We have to do this through a process called FERC, and FERC is the Federal Energy Regulation Commission that is the ones that issue the license for the dam to be able to produce energy, electricity for the city of Seattle. If we go to the next slide. Okay, so this is my fun fact page, more of a scary fact page, starting with the fact that the Skagit River is the third largest river in the West Coast, if anybody didn't know that. The Sacramento and the Columbia are the only two that are larger than the Skagit. The Skagit is the only of those three that is designated wild and scenic. In other words, it has parts of that river that are not regulated or do not have a dam on it. Like I said, the Sacramento and the Columbia both do. The Corps of Engineers estimated a 100-year flood in the Skagit to be roughly 220,000 cubic feet per second. Major population and infrastructure located in the floodplain are the city of Burlington, city of Mount Vernon, city of Cedar Woolley. Lacon or Hamilton, Lyman. Crucial infrastructure, it includes fire, public works, police, and hospitals, especially United General Peace Health. Anacortes Water Treatment Plant, I-5, Highway 9, Highway 20, 536, and Highway 11. Puget Sound Energy Transfer Stations are in the floodplain. All major grocery stores in Mount Vernon and Burlington are in the floodplain except one. And that's the Hagen on the hill. So, next slide, please. As you well know, we went through a major event here in November of 2021. That vent produced just over 130,000 cubic feet per second. I like to use this as maybe a layman's understanding of how much water that is. So 130,000 cubic feet per second, in a rough calculation, is 1 million gallon jugs of water going by in a single second. And this is not considered a flood of record. At the time of that flood, Seattle City Light had about 170,000 acre feet of storage. Under the current license, the regulated amount of water that they need, or storage they needed at that time, is only 60,000. So they had 110,000 extra acre feet of storage. But another fact is that the only dam that has storage of the three is Ross, the largest of the three dams, which is the top dam. Diablo and Gorge are considered pass-through dams. In other words, they're energy generators only. They have no storage capacity. The inflow into the Baker and the Skagit was like, the inflows into the Ross Reservoir at peak flows was approximately 67,000 cubic feet per second. Outflows at that peak were only 5. So that's how much water they were holding back at peak flows. They're holding back at somewhere around 62,000 cubic feet per second. If they didn't have that extra 110,000 acre feet of storage, the river level at Mount Vernon would have been 8 feet higher than it was at the time of the flood. Now, to put that in perspective, at the peak flow in Mount Vernon, the river was at 37.3. The highest point of the levees at that point is 41 feet. So you put 8 feet on, the river was 5 feet over the levee banks. It would have been catastrophic. The levees wouldn't have survived. Mount Vernon, Burlington, most of the Cedar-Willy's infrastructure would not have survived. So this storage we're talking about is very, very important. Procedurally, just in essence, procedurally alone, a 100-year flood, the city of Cedar-Willy wouldn't exactly be underwater, but Highway 20 would be gone. Cook Road would be gone. Highway 9 would be gone. Highway 11 would be gone. So you would literally be stranded here with no way out unless it was by air or boat. But the city of Cedar-Willy would be an island. And all your basically your critical infrastructure would be underwater, too, because the sewer treatment plant wouldn't survive. You probably wouldn't have power. Water would be an issue because we don't know how the PUD lines would hold up to that kind of flow of water. So there's a lot of ifs, but there's a lot of trues, too. Next slide, please. So this hydrograph here demonstrates quite quickly what the amount of water going that the dam had versus what they were releasing. If you see this, the jagged hydrograph there, that's the volume of water that was coming into the Baker system, into the Ross system. So you can see the peak flow that I was talking about is about 67,000. Cubic feet per second. If you look at the more solid line there, that's how much water they released. So they were that peak flow, that 67,000, they literally held it all. So next slide, please. So So the Corps of Engineers did a study here not too long ago. It's called the General Investigation Study. And in that study, they found that the most economical way to reduce flood risk is what would be called a non-structural activity. And the number one non-structural activity is storage in a dam. It is the most cost-effective. It is the most reliable. And it's the most consistent. mean, we can build bigger levees. We can make them wider. We can build levees around all infrastructures. But the cost, an average cost of a levee to build is somewhere between $6,000 and $7,000 per linear foot. So a mile of levee is millions of dollars. To get storage, to change the operation manual of a dam in order to hold more water is literally paperwork. So what we have right now as far as a group we have that's on board for this request for more storage is Skagit County, and Will's here to represent Skagit County. The Dyke District Partnership, which is the group that I chair. The Skagit Drainage Consortium, which is the group that Jen is the executive director of. And the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which is our federal agency that supports our ask. So we have a really good solid core of individuals and entities that are working towards this goal. But it's not easy because, to be honest with you, City Light is a very powerful company, and they are very set in what they want and what they have. But we're going to try to move that mark. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to my brain trust, which is Jenna Friebel, who is our hydraulic engineer, to kind of go over the more technical side of how we're going to get to this ask.
Are there any questions before you step away, Daryl?
Just a question. When you get your new engineer up, can you speak into the mic more?
I'm sorry.
I'm a little challenged on hearing.
You can do that. All right. Thank you.
Is that better? Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. But thank you for your time. Can I have the next slide, please?
Wow. Well,
okay, so we're just going to go into the details here. All right, next slide, please. This is the storage request. So this is what we're working on. We've been working on this, I'm not sure if Daryl mentioned it, for about 3 years so far. So the process started with a pre-licensing phase where we were supposed to bring our request in good faith. We've been working with City Light and all of the other licensed participants for at least 3 years, and the draft license was filed last week. So it's the federal agency is now officially involved. There are hard deadlines, and we're looking at about 2 years now to complete the process. And just for a little context, Daryl did say City Light's been difficult to work with. They've had our flood request almost for a year. And in the draft license that they filed, it's status quo. So they didn't voluntarily accept our proposed alternative for more storage. So we have an opportunity now to comment on the draft license, which is part of the reason why we're reaching out to cities. So 1946, when Ross was built, flood storage was the primary purpose. It was the main reason why it was authorized by Congress. And at that time, Congress and the Corps of Engineers did analyses and recommended 200,000 acre-feet of storage. It's a little hazy what the record is, but at the end of the day, in 1954, when the license was filed, they were only obligated for 120,000 acre-feet of storage. And so our request is really sort of consistent with what was done in the 1940s and also what we know about the operations today. So currently, City Light is required to operate Ross in accordance with what's called the Water Control Manual, which dictates when they draw down and for flood storage in the fall and how they have to meet other obligations. They also have a fish settlement agreement, which requires them to keep water in the river, and so their current operations reflect that commitment. They also have some requirements for recreation on Ross as part of the National Park. Currently, under their operations, they do start drawing down the reservoir earlier than they would just for flood control, and that's partly why they had the extra storage last year, last fall. And so as it stands today, more storage is available because of the fish settlement agreement and their current operations. Okay, so next slide, please. So this is kind of the gist of our request. So under the current license, there's flood storage capacity, 120,000 acre feet, and our request is to increase that to 200,000 acre feet. And that would be fairly in line with what they normally have and also fairly in line with what they had last fall that helped reduce the flood by 8 feet. So that total storage is really important. The other piece of our ask is earlier drawdown. So under their current license, they're required to start draining the reservoir in the fall, but they don't have to have full flood storage until December 1st. And you guys all know that our floods happen earlier than that often. And with climate change, you know, the expectation and probably the reality is that those shift earlier in the fall. And so the request also is to have the full flood storage, or ask of full flood storage available by November 1st. So shifting it a full month earlier to capture those early season floods. So the next slide, please. And this is just a reiterating kind of what we said because it's important, but the storage really is related to flood stages in the lower valley. And so 8 feet lower would have meant fairly catastrophic flooding, 8 feet higher. And these inflows are expected to become more frequent with climate change. So as the glaciers recede, as we get more intense atmospheric rivers, I mean, this is the expectation. And Daryl did mention this is a 50-year license, and so it's a one shot to make a difference for our community in the next couple years. And also just to kind of keep reiterating, this is really consistent with what was done in the 1940s. And, you know, we're not way out of line with this request. Next slide, please. So this is some background that will be in our comment letter to sort of justify the earlier drawdown. This is just a summary of the major flood events in the Skagit River watershed since the 1990s. And really the purpose of this is to remind people that these aren't sort of every other year events, but these are the major floods, 1990, 95, 2003, 2006, and then most recently. And one thing that people will hear is that, well, this was anomalous. It was an inflow of record. And it really, for Ross, it was an inflow of record. But for the watershed as a whole, these floods happen about every 25 years. And that's kind of important context when we're talking about, you know, the reasonable nature of this request and why it's important to manage for these more frequent floods. Okay, next slide, please. So the next several graphs are just kind of a visual display of how Ross Reservoir works. And so I'm hoping you guys can read that. It's a little tricky from here. But essentially we have the top line is the probable max flood. So this is what's in the water control manual. They don't want the water to get over that. And then you start having uncontrolled spill. normal flood pool. So this is in the summertime where they try to manage for recreation and other purposes at Ross. And then the gray line down below is the last 12 years of water level in the fall. So you'll see, and the USGS monitors this water level. It's not our data. It's the federal government. And you'll see that they're well below those targets. And, again, that's to sort of feed their fisheries obligations. And so this really is kind of a win-win scenario. So the next slide, please. So this shows the current license requirements. So each of those triangles is where they can't have the water above that in the fall because that means they don't have any storage. So anything below those triangular lines is extra storage, which is what Daryl was talking about earlier. And during a flood, you can kind of fill that space up. You have room to manage, and then you can draw it down after the peak of the flood has gone through the lower valley. And that's kind of how you manage flood. So this is the current license. Next slide, please. This would be our proposed change to that license. So you'll see that you have more storage, so the targets are lower. That means you have a lot of empty space in the fall. And you shift those targets a little bit earlier, so you're getting earlier drawdown, which means you have more storage available before flood season. And hopefully this is making sense. Next slide, please. This sort of shows that November flood. So starting in October, we had a really, really wet fall. So they're sort of have more water in the system than normal, But it's not unusual. But if you remember, not this current fall, but the year before, it was wet. We had like almost record-setting wet fall. And then that peak of blue line was that 21 flood. And so you'll see they filled up just to full pool, and they had the capacity to manage that. If you were to shift all of that up, you know, assuming that the reservoir was still pretty full at the time of that flood, you can see that peak would be way above where they have uncontrolled spill. And that's sort of how the reservoir works and how we would be hoping to manage it in the future to allow a lot more flexibility in storage to respond to flood events. Next slide, please. And that's kind of the summary of the technical part of this conversation. And so like I said, the next steps, City Light filed their license application last week with the federal government. We have 90 days to provide written comment on their draft license. Despite all of our efforts to get an alternative flood storage request, the filed license was status quo. And so we will file comment letters, and we're asking for support now from local cities and other jurisdictions with infrastructure in the floodplain to support our ask. City Light will file their final license application in April of this year, and the federal government will then perform a NEPA analysis on alternatives. And so part of our comment letter will be submitting what we would like to see as an alternative operating scenario for the purposes of NEPA. And so we have a lot of work to do, and bringing along the community, making people aware is a really big part of that. I guess we can just maybe stop here for questions, and Will can come up, and Daryl, but I think that there.
Well, I just have it seems like it would be logical to do this. It doesn't seem like that it is challenging them to do something that's out of the realm of what's reasonable.
Yeah.
So have you heard, or has there been given any responses to why not implementing a drawdown into their license, into their document?
I haven't heard of anything why we're not completely invited to all of their conversations, just to be candid with you. They have a lot of resource agencies, a lot of tribes, state and federal. And so I think they're trying to put together a complete package that addresses not just flood control, but fisheries and recreational needs as well. And Will is probably much better suited to answer that question. I'm just a hydrologist.
Thank you, Jenna.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the kind of history of this is important. Oh, yeah, sorry, got to talk into the microphone. Sorry.
If you want to pick the mic up and hold it, you're certainly welcome to do that. It's a wireless mic, so it should just pull off there if you'd like.
Can you hear me now? Is that good? Okay. I'll project. You know, the history of this is important, and the why of what they're doing is important, simply so that everybody in the community understands that our ask is reasonable and our cause just. So I think it is useful to talk about that for a minute. These dams are built on public land. They're built on federal land. And when they were originally built, they were sold by J.D. Ross to the federal government, to the community, as something that was going to be this great benefit and provide flood control. And indeed, the first purpose, operational priority of this project is flood control. So we are entitled to ask for this. These dams, the first reason they're there is flood control. Power production comes after that. When they were built, of course, they were built in phases. Ross was originally built starting in 1937, authorized in 37. And in the 40s, after the war, they were going to raise it. The Army Corps, and this is Congress, put the Army Corps of Engineers in charge of flood control for the country. So they have some standing in this conversation, you might say. They said, we want 200,000 acre feet by the 1st of November. This is in the order from the federal government, and this is exactly what we're asking for today. City Light argued at length, lots of political machinations over the ensuing few years, as they're quite good at it, as we found out, basically argued that we need to keep these pools full right up until December, because otherwise we lose all this power production for the wintertime. Some more machinations occur over the next couple of years, and then there's a an order, poorly reasoned, that it adopts this reasoning and says, go ahead and lower it to 120,000 acre feet by the 1st of December, sort of based on a bad analysis of when floods happen around here, frankly. I mean, you look at your sense is that they happen a lot in November and sometimes in October. That's because they do. So that's what we've been stuck with. Now, the world's changed pretty substantially since then. First of all, as Jenna mentioned, you know, because of environmental requirements for fish, they've had to start spilling water in late summer, early fall. That draws down the reservoir coming in the fall. The other thing is lots of people have air conditioning now, so there's big load in the late summer. So dump water, make electricity. So they're doing this for fish. The reason that level is much lower than they're required to do is not because they're nice folks that want to protect us. It's because the law requires them to spill water for fish and because they're making electricity in a way different than they did before. By the way, if they don't have enough electricity, they're a public power entity, so they can buy highly subsidized power from the Bonneville Power Administration. So they do have other options. You know, so that's all we're asking for, really, here, is they continue to operate the dams in the way that they're currently operating them. We're not asking for any substantial change. We're just asking that over the next 50 years, become the protocol as a matter of law. So their argument, this gets me to your question, why are they saying no? They're saying no, ultimately, but we don't know. They're not telling us, but ultimately, it's to keep their options open. They want to keep their options open in case there's a change in the market, change in precipitation patterns because of climate change, this sort of thing. And that makes, I suppose, perfect sense from the standpoint of them, but it's a bad deal for us because you're keeping an option open to flood us, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Just boil down to it. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, we are, you know, in a good position. Politically, we have the support of the Army Corps of Engineers, and you know our ask is reasonable. It's reflective of what was required when this dam was originally constructed. So, what we're looking for, as Jenna suggested, is that we come together as a community. We're going to be fleshing out our comment letter, laying out the history, laying out the operational and hydrological support for what we're asking, demonstrating that the economics aren't a problem, and so on and so forth. And we're going to be looking for all the jurisdictions in the community that rely on this flood storage to join us, file something in the record, and support it. So, questions?
Thank you. Yeah. Yes, go ahead, Mr. Allen.
Who are the main adversaries or opponents? Are the tribes, or have you reached agreements with the tribes and all that?
So as far as the tribal side of it is that we've actually been working very closely with Upper Skagits to make sure that our needs and their needs are in line so that we're not creating conflict. We've had more than a couple of meetings with their staff people who, you know, work obviously directly with their council. And they're very comfortable with what we're asking for. In fact, we're actually right now, the partnership has hired a hydraulic firm to do the modeling. And not only are they doing the modeling for our flood storage, they're also adding in a caveat that the Upper Skagits are asking for, which is fish passage, mm-hmm. which takes an extra flow of water to bypass the dams for fish migration, right? So to answer that question, we're working very closely with the tribes, and we have a really comfortable relationship, which is wonderful. The adversarial part is it comes down to be honest with you, City Light likes the way they run it right now. And if they can do anything possible to keep it that way, they're going to do everything in their power to keep the status quo because it's comfortable.
Are there any other questions?
I'm assuming since the government's entertaining this 50-year lease in the first place that the dam is still structurally sound and the Army Corps of Engineers has already signed off on it holding this capacity?
There's significant safety inspection requirements and so forth. I mean, yeah, that's a big part of this equation, yeah. For sure. Yeah,
yeah, those dams are they're regulated power facilities. They are constantly surveyed, maintenance, tested. I mean, they're just, and that's part of the whole process of the licenses. You know, the existing licenses is the maintenance, and you know, the maintenance and operation. You got to make sure that you're operating with a safe feature. So,
I was making that presumption, but learned not to make those.
it's a good question, but yeah, it's very. I mean, all the dams on the Skagit are regulated very highly.
Good. All right. Thank you.
Good, Mr. McGoffin.
Okay. Thank you. This has been informative. I didn't know that we had this capacity to. The question I have is, you know, if we support this and the other cities also support it, who has the final say on including it? Like, can they just walk away from it and file it how they want? Or can the federal government say, you know, we've got the Army Corps of Engineers and all these cities? And
yeah, so it depends on how things move. City Light could incorporate or ask, especially if it fits in with the environmental ask, right? If all the pieces fit together, they kind of don't have much choice. But they can deny all our asks, and then it falls upon the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to make a determination. So it falls heavily upon them. We can be an intervener, so we can legally. It's kind of like filing a lawsuit. We can legally intervene with the process of the license, which would take it to a federal court to make a determination on the storage, and the tribes can do the same thing. NOAA Fisheries can do that. You know, National Parks, Natural Forest Service. If you feel that you're being treated wrongly in the process of the license, you have the right to intervene. If that answers your question.
You know, to follow up on. Their final license application is due in April. Susanna Frame and King 5 reported that they've spent $40 million on the process so far, and they have no agreement with anyone. Their license draft, so they file a draft, we all comment on it in the finals. Their draft license application is just, we're going to keep doing what we've been doing. No agreement on anything. So I say this to say that intervention is pretty highly likely. We're probably going to have to intervene to make sure our needs are met. So we're preparing to do that, obviously.
It's kind of shocking to me. I see Mr. Lavaca has joined us, and he also has a question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I was just wondering, would this have in any way averted the 2021 flood that happened or lessened it in a greater impact than what we experienced?
Yeah, the beginning of the presentation, I know you came late, and then I understand that. So the fact that City Light had excess storage in 21, they actually took 8 feet off the flood. Okay. So their operations during 21 basically saved our community. But it wasn't because it was in the license or because they were being good neighbors. It was just because that's the way they were operating the dams, if that clarifies for you.
The water.
Yeah, you bet it does. Yeah, I was here for that part, but I wasn't sure if that if it would affect, or if we're looking at future projections of worse flooding, and that's what we would basically avoid if we were going to get that kind of a spike at nearly 37 anyway.
Yeah, so John Chandler, who is the dam manager for Puget Sound Energy, has done some analysis on flood frequency and done some projections, and that it's not going to get any better. I guess that would be the point. With the projection of climate change, our flood frequency is going to increase. The velocity of the floods are projected to have a higher volume increase. So we're not looking at the future as having less floods and less severe floods. It's completely the opposite. The projections are more frequent floods, larger floods, more radical weather.
Yeah, and actually, our own public works director has reported to us a couple different times when he's given presentations that we've actually seen down at the wastewater treatment plant an increase in the amount of rain and also the wind. So our own plant has been impacted by weather change that that is occurring. So. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's also a good thing to note, like, this is only one piece of flood readiness and flood risk reduction. It's an important one, and the time is now to do the storage piece of it. But there are a lot of other things that the DIKE partnership does, the county does, the cities do for flood readiness, flood risk reduction, and those are all ongoing and will obviously be important actions. So this is just the one piece of it, which is the storage, which is really, you know, the next year or two is the key time to get involved if we're going to reduce risk through additional storage.
The one comment that I had when I heard this presentation at SCOG was that I felt like FEMA should get involved, that you should actually talk to FEMA simply because they're the ones who pour millions of dollars back into our community, rebuilding our community, and you would think that they would have a financial vested interest in wanting to see the best possible case of reducing flood risk for this area.
Yeah, and we agree. And actually, we're probably going to – so Jack Moore does the community rating system for Skagit County. So I think we'll vet that through Jack because he has the contacts for that. And, you know, I think flood storage is actually part of the puzzle for the community rating system too. So FEMA would need to know that information.
Okay.
You know, I think it's really important to follow up on what Jenna says, is that this isn't the golden egg, but it's pretty silver plated. Mm-hmm. If we can get this, because it does give us the abilities to better manage floods in Skagit Valley. And I mean, I'm an infrastructure guy, I'm a dike guy, but it's not the answer. We can't keep building bigger dikes and trying to hold more water when we can hold it before it gets here.
Right. Okay. Any other comments or questions? So the one thing that I did ask, and I hear you say that you're going to be putting out a letter, and I will happily sign that letter. That's not an issue for me. But I think that I will present it to the council, and I'll take a poll to see if they're interested in that. But writing our own letter and having each of you sign it as well, I don't know if that's important to you. If so, we'll compose that letter. We can make that happen.
Yeah. Thank you. We can help you file it in the FERC record.
Oh, excellent. Thank you.
Yeah.
Good deal.
FERC has created a comment porthole that
okay.
we can send the stuff into so that we don't have to hard copy it.
Okay.
We can actually put it through the porthole.
So. Okay. So to whom do I send it, or would we send it?
We'll filter everything we will.
I'll take care of it.
Okay.
We're looking to have our... So the comment letter we're going to write is obviously going to be pretty expansive and detailed and technical. And I think what we're envisioning is just have the additional letters of support that you could file. So, you know, we support the County Consortium Partnership letter dated January 31st.
Mm-hmm.
You can file that. Not all help.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think it's important for the city to recognize how important flood risk management is to your infrastructure and to your public, and that storage is a key factor.
10 feet or 8 feet of Mount Vernon would have also been 8 feet here.
Oh, we were well aware. We had some tense moments here, and as everybody at the dais here knows, we had only really one way in and out of Sijuli. That was it.
Yeah.
Our other routes were closed to us for a couple days.
And not to be a Debbie Downer, but you guys are ahead of the Nookachamp storage, so more than likely it would be overheat.
Wow.
Because Nookachamp takes a load off anywhere from six inches to a foot.
Okay.
Sorry, Nookachamp people, I hate to say that, but yeah, it is a storage and a relief for downstream water. So, yeah, Sijuli would see a higher level.
Hmm.
Like I said, it's not to be a Debbie Downer, but...
Yeah. I do have a boat.
That's why when you look at hydrographs, you see that, you know, concrete might read 40, 45 feet Mount Vernon, you know, when it finally gets to Mount Vernon, it might be only 43 because there's release points, you know, release points above Cedar Willy and release points below Cedar Willy that allow that water to drop a little bit.
I also think about Clear Lake. Clear Lake saw some water levels that they haven't seen in quite a while, yes. And I do know people who live over there, and it was shocking.
Yeah.
Shocking. All right. Thank you so much for taking time out of your evening, and we will be in touch.
Thank you, Council. Thank you,
yeah,
Madam
thank
Mayor.
You. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. All right. So welcome, Councilman Lavaca. I'm glad that you could join us. So moving on, we are going to move to the first item on the agenda, which is a possible contract with Family Promise for the expenditure of House Bill 1406, Affordable and Supportive Housing Funds. And Mr. Bush.
Thank you, Mayor Johnson, City Council. Good evening. Audrey Wool is also on Zoom tonight from Family Promise and can get into more detailed answers to questions that you may have as well about their services. Just to give you a little bit of background, House Bill 1406 has been around a few years. It's basically state sales tax money. It's just not working, huh? All right, let me just pull it off. How's that? Is that better? Excellent. Thank you. I'm going to lose my voice if I yell at it all night. So House Bill 1406 has been around a few years at this point. We have accumulated about $33,000 in revenue. It is state sales tax money that is actually credited back to the city. It can only be used for affordable housing purposes, so it is limited. And there's been a question. I recall a meeting of the finance personnel committee of the council where we talked about how to use this funding. It was many months ago now, but Family Promise was one of those suggestions. And so to continue that conversation, we've brought forward to you tonight just a sample professional services agreement that would be with Family Promise for the provision of services in Cedro Woolley. And as I said, Audrey can speak to that more. They would basically work on expending the initial money that's in our account. We're accumulating about $14,000 per year, so that money would continue to build up going forward. But they would spend the initial $33,000. They're working on a strategic planning process right now, and as a result of that strategic planning, they would have more thoughts and a report for us at the end of 2023, and then you would have the opportunity. It's a 1-year contract. You'd have the opportunity to decide if you wanted to continue to provide services. So we did have some changes to the scope of work that we included. We put this together in a few days last week, so it was a bit consolidated. We didn't have the finance director in town, and I wanted her to take a look at making sure that we're spending these funds accurately according to the House bill. And we want to make some tweaks to what we included in the budget that's at the end of the scope of work. So we will do that. What we're really asking you for is just authorization to allow the mayor to enter into a contract with Family Promise. So that's the ask. And what I'd like to do is turn it over to Audrey if she's got some additional comments in terms of the services that will be provided, and she can talk about the changes. I sent you an email as well.
All right. Thank you. And welcome, Audrey. Thank you for joining us this evening.
Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Awesome. Okay. So as most of you know, Family Promise is both national and local, and we serve homeless families in our community with shelter, transitional housing, aftercare, shelter diversion and prevention services, and the list just goes on. One of the things that we have really been focused on is, since we're located in Cedro Woolley and have the highest homeless children numbers in Cedro Woolley, really figuring out some housing solutions that we can take part in and creating more housing for our neighbors. And I believe with this funding, some of the things we were looking at doing, we're still kind of figuring out what would be appropriate for this funding pool. But for sure, the $15,000 of rental assistance would help us to offset some of the costs that rents have gone up and a lot of families can't afford. So we could provide some general case management and financial literacy, rental assistance, and then also some landlord tenants classes for individual or families with children who would be able to then afford the housing on their own after a year. We are also looking in our strategic planning on purchasing a transitional house that we've been operating since 2017 here in Cedro Woolley. And we're hoping to use about $10,000 of this funding for the down payment. And we're working on if whether or not this funding would allow us to also use $8,000 towards the acquisition support, basically support staffing to continue to provide rental assistance and acquire more funding that would pay off housing for new units here in Cedar Valley.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions for Audria? I got to tell you, we were very excited about this whole thing. Everybody on board here, I think, is excited about the fact that we have this funding and we're able to offer it to you, and greatly appreciate you coming on and letting us know what it is that you're thinking about doing with it, and I guess vetting it, right? You have to vet it to make sure that it meets the 1406 requirements, correct?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and we had just a little amount of time to do that, but we did base it off. I did apply for this funding in Mount Vernon as well. I received it. So I'm trying to do something similar, but adding a little twist with our transitional houses are here, and how can we create that to be a more stable programming for to offer more units.
Yeah, we thank you that you're keeping the money here in Cedar Valley. I know that's one thing that was important to our council members. Thank you.
Okay, so we'll bring that back on the 14th for final action if the council's so inclined. And yes. Nick's got a question.
Go ahead, Nick.
Oh, I was surprised at the number of homeless children in Cedar Valley, and is that the city of Cedar Valley? Is that all of Cedar Valley? But either way, that's still, there was like 318. Is that a correct number?
As of, that was, I think, 2020, we had 318, which was actually a year that was poorly documented. So I am interested to get the new numbers. They should be, there should be some new numbers coming out soon.
Is this through McKinney-Vento? Is this through McKinney-Vento?
Yes, based on McKinney-Vento, yeah.
All right. And so those are all homeless documented children that are living in Cedar Valley. It just doesn't seem like we even have a population that big. It's a lot. Yeah,
there's a lot of people in Cedar. They're doubled up living in places that are putting like multiple families at risk because they're living like three families in one house. And we have a lot of that going on here in Cedar Valley. And just recently now that the rental costs have gone up, I think like we're on our third time now, we are having to give a lot of rental assistance to through our shelter diversion programming, one-time assistance checks to keep people in their housing. And the rate of that is growing quite a bit.
Okay. So it's like multiple families living in single units.
Yeah.
Single units. And then the cost of rent also going up. Do you know if they're working or if they have job opportunities? I'm not the kids, but the parents. Or is it all kids living in a multifamily unit? I'm just thinking 318 is quite a bit for a population our size. It's a giant percent when you consider how many children to grandparents to parents there are.
And there is some possibility. We have always had the highest numbers. There is some possibility because during 2019 and 2020, there was the feeding programs where people were coming to different school districts. So there is possibility that there was crossover. And then there was also a lot of people that were getting counted for different things. So the numbers were really astray. But these are families who tend to be working. Mainly the families we serve are situationally homeless, like have become sick and can't go to work for multiple weeks or fallen short because of a lost job opportunity or failed transportation or things of that nature. We're not talking about generally, they're not families that are on the streets. Most of the families that we see in Cedar Valley are at risk of losing housing. And that number is growing due to the cost of housing now.
Well, we really appreciate all that you guys are doing. Family Promise is an awesome program. And thank you, Mayor Julia, for having that on the forefront of your heart. That's a big one.
Thank you, Councilman Lavaca, for also being supportive of this. I just wanted to make one quick comment that I do know the McKinney-Vento, the numbers that are coming out, that has to do with all the different schools within the Cedar Valley School District. And we do know how vast that is and how spread out that is. So it may seem like a large number, but when you consider the different communities within the Cedar Valley School District, it's really not as great as perhaps we think. So, any other else, Nick? I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No problem. Here's a lot. I mean, of course. I was just wondering, would we see data on, or I'm sure you already collect that data for different communities, but children that are homeless per the children living in that community or enrolled in schools, just so you see the metrics of decreasing the number, or if the numbers are growing, or if the efforts putting forth or if more efforts go in, and then also bring those rates back to the council or different organizations. 4% of your youth are homeless, or 5 or 10. I mean, 10 would be like 3,000 kids in our community, right? 3,180. So that would be, that would be a lot of kids, a lot of percentage.
Yeah, we are recently, over the last year and a half, we've taken on a new database system that we are hoping, we are continuing to load more and more information in. And as we're starting to do more of these more in-depth programs, we will be able to get more data. And we continue to work both locally and nationally with McKinney Vento programs to make sure that the models we're putting out are best practice to reduce the numbers within our communities. It's so much easier, though, I'll tell you, when the schools are open and we can partner with the McKinney Vento and the counselors that are in schools, as opposed to trying to work with some of the homeschooling models that we had during COVID. So I think over this last year and a half, it's really been revving back up, getting people in offices, getting them in actual classes so we can start working on financial literacy and how do we make budgets around this new normal with inflation and rents and everything. I think we'll probably see another spike before we see a decrease with what's going on in our economy right now. But the goal is to reduce the number of homelessness. Wouldn't it be the dream to end it? So,
yeah, that's wonderful. Okay, thank you. So this week we're coming back to the council next Wednesday, and this is a first read, and we will make a move on it next Wednesday. All right. Thank you, Audria. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. All right, moving on to item number 2, which is adopting a salary schedule for the non-represented employees. This is resolution 111022, and it's a second read. So, Mr. Bush?
Thank you, Mayor Johnson. And we have with us tonight as well Vance Jacobson, our consultant who worked on the study. He's going to provide you a presentation with some more background. There were some questions that came up at the last meeting, so we thought it would be a good idea to take a little bit of time during this work session to provide you more detail and do our best job to answer all the questions that you may have. A copy of Vance's presentation is before you this evening, so just so it's a little easier to follow along, some of the slides are fairly detailed. And just really quickly, again, by way of background, this is a study we launched it to in the late spring, and Vance conducted throughout the summer and completed this fall for both the AFSCME bargaining unit and non-represented employees. And the result of that study was a recommended wage schedule for employees in both groups. And how that relates to this particular action item is that historically the city council has approved a salary schedule for non-represented employees, and that now becomes a resolution to adopt a salary, basically a wage schedule for those employees going forward. So that's why this is before you tonight, and that's why we're asking Vance to present. And so what I'm going to do is turn it over to Vance. He's happy to answer detailed questions, and then we can go from there. Vance?
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Mayor, and council members for inviting me tonight. And what I'd like to do is walk through the presentation that I have made earlier to employee groups. This one, however, spends a little bit more time on how we got to where we are right now. The actual, on page 2, the actual action plan that was devised for this project really consisted of 4 key steps. And in any compensation effort, a professional salary administration consultant would really never go out to the competitive market until they come to grips with the internal alignment of jobs. And for cities and for manufacturing and retail and education and healthcare, most use a tried and true measuring system that you know that really aligns jobs not only by skill, difficulty, and accountability, but also devised to get the right kind of spacing to offer incentive for people to move through skill-based levels and leadership levels, et cetera. And I'll come back to that in terms of some of the details on how that's done. The second thing is then the competitive trends. We conduct research on what we believe is a realistic labor market from which to draw salary range information from, and then assess the city's own competitive standing vis-a-vis that information. Now, one of the principles of doing a salary survey is really to be able to get data for a position, you need a minimum sample of 5. And beyond that, then it's organizations within a reasonable commute, i.e., say 30 to 45 minute commute, and others that have similar opportunities and constraints, both from the revenue side and the recruiting and retention side of things. We think we came up with a very well thought out sampling. Coincidentally, that sampling also included a core group of 5 communities that were determined last November based on a contractual agreement with the AFSCME bargaining unit. The third step is, after those two steps, we have a listing of job, we have a listing of data. The third step is to design a master salary schedule. And before I go to that, I'm gonna go ahead a few pages and then back up to the aligning of jobs, because that's really important to know. The Equal Pay Act says that you can differentiate the pay in jobs based on differences in skill, effort, conditions, and responsibility. The measuring system we used has 3 kinds of skills: mental, physical, social, or human relations, and 3 kinds of effort: problem, challenges, physical effort, and the range of people you have to work with on matters of substance to get your work done. Conditions are conditions. They're things that make the job disagreeable and also things that make them less than perfect conditions. Lastly, responsibility level. This gives us a opportunity to design a measuring tool for our continued ability to align these jobs from low to high. This is an excerpt of 1 of 5 pages of the instrument, whereas if a job required we'll just be real succinct with it. If it required, and this is on the fourth slide, 4 to 5 years of experience or an associate's degree, and the problem-solving challenges had either logistics or technical kinds of things, as you would suspect with an engineering technician, or many of the people that work in the wastewater treatment environment, as well as your accounting support staff. Once you repeat this process 5 times, you come up with a numerical value page 5 for all jobs. Now, this happens to be the jobs that were part of AFSCME, but we have done this all the way from the lowest job, that's the park caretaker, all the way up to city administrator, to where we have used a specialized coding system that gives each job a numerical value. As you see on that page 5, if you go to administrative analyst, there's an 1866, and if you go to the bottom one, it's 1605. That numerical value will ultimately put it into a pay grade and into a range where other jobs will be clustered into that range. Now we go back to this chart. So what we've done here is we've aligned the jobs and we've given all jobs a numerical value. And that numerical value enables us to start making mathematical connections. And this is where we go over to item number 3 on the second page, making mathematical connections between the market and the internal alignment, and that gives us the ability to design a top-to-bottom salary structure. I'm going to move ahead from that chart that had the jobs, and I'm going to go to page 6, which shows a graphical illustration of what we're talking about. So we've gone through the exercise. If you look at the horizontal axis, and this is the mathematics that are used for this is basic high school geometry and trigonometry. We've got jobs that scored certain point values, and they are now in certain salary grades going across. And for a sample of those jobs, we've gone out, as the report would show, to the competitive market, and we have collected certain data, the average start rate, the average position in the range after 4 or 5 years, and the average lifetime or average maximum somebody would have at, in the range of 12 to 15 years in the job. And so we construct this visual representation. The bottom and the top dotted lines represent the points at which below that bottom line is the bottom 25% of the market. Above that top line is the upper 25% of the market. There is a center line. And if your handouts are in color, the center line is in orange. That reflects the median or the absolute middle of the market. Now, some organizations can't afford to pay there. Some organizations want to pay a little bit ahead. Most organizations, the larger you get, probably err to the middle because they have plentiful career ladders and plentiful other opportunities that maybe a small organization wouldn't necessarily have. The second to the bottom dotted line is a representation. On my chart, it's actually red. But it is a second to the bottom lines. That is a representation between internal alignment and the ranking of the jobs that based on CDRA salary ranges. And what we're trying to show here is that CDRA Woolley pretty much unilaterally, with the exception of some positions, is somewhat below the median in the market. The combined for all employee groups, the combined percentile we calculated as a 43rd percentile. That does not mean that you're 7% below the median. It means that if you surveyed 100 people, person number 50 would be the median and you are person number 43. And your differential between where you're at and the median could be as, it could be as much as 8%, or it could be as little as 3%. It's a relative positioning. What it just says is that 57% of the market pays higher for comparable jobs. Now, in developing the salary range, we use this chart as really our primary basis. We start with the middle line, and then we move up and down based on the whole theory of bringing somebody new into the job, and that most jobs that are skilled and technical and managerial in nature have a 8 to 12 year life cycle that takes you all the way from being a learner to be basically competent, to be proficient, and then have mastery for those people that are at the top of the range. We use that same philosophy. Anyway, so in experimenting with different levels and different experiences that we've learned within the city of for recruiting, we concluded that we should be recommending that the city set the middle of its salary ranges as close to the 60th percentile in the market. That means that when somebody's been here, 4 to 6 years, that you could actually honestly say to them that you've reached our target as being paid ahead of 60% of the competition. And then as they continue in their career development through that particular job, they still have room to move. I'm going to go back to page 2 and just highlight the fourth area. Okay, we've aligned the jobs, we've done the competitive research, and we've used that research to mathematically construct our master salary schedule. And that's the master 13-step schedule that is presented to the council for formal adoption, particularly for the non-represented staff, but also as a guideline for setting salaries for the represented groups, with the with the hope that if all things went well, we would honestly say to people, we have a consistent pay philosophy up and down, top to bottom, unilaterally in the organization. The fourth is once we get the structure built, now we roll people onto the structure. And it's a pretty straightforward process. First of all, we'd look at recent adjustments like a COLA last November, and then we would look at any other factors. We would recommend a minimum guarantee to any employee, and then we assign them to the next step up. I'll show you how that works. If we adjust everybody's base salary by 2.5%, and then we assign them to the closest step up. So let's take employee A with 7 years experience. This is page number 7 on your presentation, right? Just following the graph. you take that employee with at 7 years, and at 32-30 they would be in between these two, between step five and six, they would round up to $33 an hour. Now, we have within the city a lot of people that are topped out in their current range. So we have somebody with the identical same salary who's got 16 years in that job. Well, our model would say that that's a potential inequity. So in addition to rounding them from $32.30 to $33, we would recommend another step. And in this example, these aren't real, the actual numbers really, but in this example, that person with longer time in the job would now be making more than the person than the other person, and that is a way that we deal with enhancing internal equity. And the so one of the key things is doing the rounding. Is that in the first year of converting to a new schedule, not everybody gets the same amount. There will be equity adjustments. There will be rounding. But after that, then it's a level playing field. And I might add that the way the salary ranges, the way the steps in those salary ranges are designed, after you hit the middle or the market target, the percentage increases on the steps go down pretty substantially. So this year the goal has been to hold the budget impact at about 5%, and you know, plus or minus a quarter of a percent, and we are right on that target, not only for the non-represented, but also we've been guided by that that implementation philosophy that the board established all along. We think it's a well thought out and a fair thing to do. So the nice thing about having wider salary ranges, when you go down to the bottom of this page, you'll see a start. And then you'll see a sampling of different steps. And I'm going to focus you on the start all the way out to step 13. That's the 12-year mark. Now, that could be longer if you took from 10 to 13 instead, unless there is some exemplary performance, we might offer those steps on a biannual basis. And those steps are a smaller percentage, but at least on a biannual basis, the cash flow, you know, would be cut in half and spread out twice as long. The starting from the starting rate to that, basically that step number, five, really is a close reflection of those percentage increments that exist right now within the current bargaining unit contracts. And so the whole theory is when you start at the minimum, we want to move you through to the market rate at a little bit faster rate. Once we get above the market targets, we want to slow you down. And that's the cost containment piece. One of the other great advantages of having wider ranges is having more flexibility at the bottom of the range for hiring in people, and some guidance, which we have a tool, you know, for city administration to use on, based on this person's background, where between the first step and the fifth step would I make them an offer? What would be my flexibility in making an offer to that person based on those, and then we would have a basic ceiling, if you will, that's where the offers would be. Then that means that incumbent who was presumed to be highly qualified would also have 7 or 8 more steps of salary growth over time. One of the things that contributes to turnover is the issue with the salary growth over time, and not having that. People do start looking around. I'm going to take you back to the second tab, and you heard my introduction to how we would identify and deal with pay inequities. One of the things is resolving those is we can't go back in history and fix everything, but what we can do is offer those employees that we've identified an explanation that this is a good faith effort just to create a little bit of spread and keep you ahead for a short time of other people. And that's a reflection of their proficiency or mastery in their job. And that comes with time. Now, interestingly, most of the recipients of these adjustments, we have some people, both in the non-represented and the AFSCME side that came out being currently paid below the minimum of the new ranges. And those minimums have been set, a distance from the minimum wage law. But the minimum wage law in Washington has been going up at a rather exponential rate, and there's really not much we can do about it. Yeah, but yet we think we've responded in a way that's good. So, but most of the recipients who are getting these adjustments are the longer term staff members that have been at the top of their position. It doesn't have anything to do with their time with the organization. It's the time in their position. And that's where some of that money would be spent, and that is all taken care of within the 5% limit. And I didn't think I could get it done that fast.
All right. Thank you, Vance. Do you have any of the comments, Charlie?
I think just from council, we just want to make sure that we've answered any questions you may have. On Vance's slide number 2, there was a question at the last meeting about have we looked at Skagit County, and you'll see Skagit County, Anacortes, Mount Vernon, and Burlington on that list of comparable organizations that we've pulled data from, so I wanted to point that out. To Vance's point, this is in the budget the council's approved, this money for both 2023 and 2024, and I guess leave it at that for now. There's a resolution there for council action this evening, if you're so inclined, or certainly on the 14th. But we do need to take action on something by the end of the year.
Okay. So before I put that before the council, I know that Councilman LaVaca submitted a couple of questions. I just want to make sure, Councilman LaVaca, that your questions were answered.
Yes, Madam Mayor, I do appreciate that. I did come up with a couple more questions during that, and since that, if I may ask those.
Absolutely, go ahead.
I was wondering if this salary is pre-tax, post-tax, and then I'll only ask 2 off the bat rather than flooding with all 4. But we have a salary marker here for 1 to 12 for the interns, and I was curious on are interns considered long-term, or do we hire interns at a long-term basis?
I can comment on interns, and then Vance, if you want to pick up the salary one, we can go there. But we don't typically pay interns in the organization. He did go ahead and include that in the salary schedule just so we'd have some guidance on that topic. But historically, we've had short-term sometimes longer-term volunteer interns. We have received a grant that I can think of in the past and last year in the finance department where we did have some outside funding to support an intern.
Good. And in response on the pre-tax versus post-tax, these are salaries that are pre-tax. If somebody has a $7,000 salary, taxes will be taken out of that check. And however, it does not include Mr. Levaca, the extra statutories that you have for Medicaid, Medicare and Medicaid taxes, as you know, that you would see on people's W-2s and on the city's W-3. And so there is an add-on for those. It also does not include the employer's contribution to PERS and other things. So this would be basically, the gross salary on the monthly paycheck.
And then for cost of living in 2 years, in 3 years, how does this relate to that? I know that every couple of years there's a cost of living increase. Is this going to be a performance-based increase of duration of time, or is this trying to wrap up the cost of living as well?
Well, there's a couple of ways to approach that one. When you design a salary structure like this, the combination of structure movement and a step movement would be part of that equation for you coming up with any additional COLA. But the salary structure as it's set up, the city will have a, once approved, I'll finalize the, we have a computer-aided decision support model that you can put in various COLA numbers, and it'll automatically backfill the salary grid, a new salary grid, and it'll assign people to the range, and it'll give you a cost. And so it's all meant to stay up to date with what's going on in the world and your labor market.
So for like a budget proposal in 2024, 2025, if there's cost of living increase, COLA goes up, you can just show what that would look like off this foundation we're establishing.
Absolutely. And the resulting cost estimates you get from that, you know, for the whole structure plus administrative moves, will be right down to the dollar.
Our finance director had mentioned, because we were discussing getting a possible part-time person, or even, I don't know if it was full-time or part-time intern, to help support their Friday activities, not necessarily an accounting, but more of looking at accounting clerk, but not even really with the accounting clerk type. He was mentioning that could be in the range of 80 grand or upward. But here it looks like for like an entry level or even with a little bit of experience is 50. And that's an increase up. Would that 30 come from benefits, or is that more of a Charlie question? Would that come from vacation? I don't know where that would come from.
Yeah. I could probably start out by answering it that regardless of the position, regardless of whether it's full-time, part-time, if you hire a new accountant, a degreed accountant, that would measure into a certain grade. If you hired a new accounting clerk to do entry level to take the data entry load off your technicians, that would come in at a certain range and a certain cost. And then once you've done that all by going through the measuring process.
I would just add, go ahead.
Yeah.
Sorry, Vance, go ahead.
No, I just think, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I would just add, we also have to assess whether it's a union position or a non-union position in terms of the type of work that's being done. And then if it's a union position, we've got to work with the union to make sure we classify it correctly. If it's a non-union position, you know, one of the things we would certainly do is look to the grid here for some guidance. And then whether it's benefited or not depends upon how full-time it is or not. If it's full-time, it's clearly benefited. If it goes over a certain threshold, it's clearly benefited. Otherwise, it's not.
So I have to say there's been some really good work that's been done here. Actually, in a relatively short period of time, we were concerned about that. Didn't know that if we could finish it before the end of the year, because council did ask us to go back and look for someone who could come in at a much less cost to do this work, and Vance has done that. I am wondering if there are any more questions, and if not, is the council ready to move on this?
Madam Mayor, Charlie, I noticed that you had a lot of, on the computer, a lot of changes on what the job descriptions were. It's like you came in as a supervisor, now you're an administrator. It's all semantics to me. Usually if you add on a supervisory title or something, wages go up. And, you know, this, I would just like to see more definite increase in prices on what our wages are going to increase. I don't read spreadsheets real well. I'm just kind of a bread and butter, toast and jam kind of guy, and I would like just an easy explanation. So we don't have to vote on this tonight or anything, right?
You certainly don't have to.
It's only the second read. We have to decide at the end of the year, but
that'd be
you
next
know,
Wednesday.
If you can get me an easy explanation, something that I can decipher real well, I would appreciate that.
This may help a little bit, but you're spending $83,000 in ongoing funding, $35,000 in ARPA funding. And combined, that represents a 5.1% increase for the group as a whole of non-represented employees. I don't know if that's along the lines of what you're looking for.
Pretty much the nuts and bolts of what it is.
Yeah.
I've got no problem voting on something.
Mm-hmm. In terms of titling, generally speaking, the term supervisor means that you're responsible for day-to-day production and you are supervising hourly people directly. When you get to manager and director, the title implies that you are burdened with more budget responsibility and you are supervising management professional and a combination of hourly folks. And so the titling schemes that we've recommended are those that we think fit the federal government's definition of occupational classes per the Equal Opportunity Commission.
Okay, so I'm working under the Bush administration right now.
No, you're not. No, but Vance did, you know, in looking at all those jobs in the detail he described, he was looking for the appropriate titles that would match the work, and that's where those recommendations come from.
Okay. This all looks good, Charlie. This market trend, but this is Cedar Woolley. I mean, there's some cities that are pretty plush in tax base. Cedar Woolley is not real plush in tax base. And we cannot, or some cities cannot follow this graph. It's sad to say, but Cedar Woolley is doing okay, I'm sure. I don't know just how good we're doing, but I know that if we had tax base at Anacortes or even Burlington, you know, we could afford to stay on this line. But I don't know. This is kind of Greek to me because I'm from the old school, and I like to see dollars, and you know, I ask for dollars compared to. To Burlington, Anacortes, Arlington, And then I like to stay on a plane. I like to stay on a plane with the population, and we can stay fairly close together. But I don't know. I kind of agree with Glenn. I'd like to wait one more meeting to make my decision. Of course, I'm just one person. But if it was a reduction of 2%, well, I'd go along with it. And no, I understand, Charlie. You guys have the education and the experience, and a lot of people we have are fairly new, and we don't really know what kind of production they're going to put out or how they're going to fulfill their job. And it would be awful to give somebody a pay raise when they're here for a month or two. But I'm just one, and I would like to hold off. But if I'll leave it up to the council, they override me, well, that's fine.
If it's helpful at all, Appendix A of the study, which there are some paper copies floating around, and it's in the packet as well. It'll be in next week's packet also. Appendix A is actually the data that Vance collected, and it shows really where our positions match up from a percentile basis to the other jurisdictions that we looked at. So it gives you some idea of kind of where we are, and so those are the numbers. Vance, I don't know if you want to comment further on how you went about that work.
I made some very quick comments earlier about the market. We obviously used Burlington, Anacortes, and that, but we did not select very many jobs from like Mount Vernon or Skagit County because of the scope of things made the jobs not a very good match. But what we also did by surveying cities that have similar limitations, like you take the Hoquiams, the Port Angeleses of the world, the Sheltons, all who are in the sample, those are all cities that have lost their lumber mills. They've lost Simpson Timber. They've lost others, and they struggle to, you know, to set a municipal budget. Every one of them, and so we think we've actually served the survey right by including those because of looking at financial limitations, and in those to get skilled folks, a couple of those would really surprise you what they need to pay to get people.
Okay, thank you, Vance. Mr. Burns.
I guess I forget that I worked for a corporation more than a decade, so I'm right at home with these spreadsheets. It didn't give me much trouble looking through these. And from what I see, this is probably what's necessary to keep good employees from going ahead and moving on to one of these other municipalities. From my experience with that corporation, I can tell you that when we did 18-cent and 39-cent raises, the good people went bye-bye really quick. It really comes down to that. There's some loyalty to community and people wanting to be where they enjoy working, but that doesn't necessarily keep a roof over your head. And so I can understand the city wanting to do this. I don't really see anything wrong with the numbers here as far as discrepancies. I think that the STEP program is actually a really good idea. It makes it so that people see an increase in their salary yearly. There's not long gaps in between, so there's a little bit of satisfaction there as well. And it also seems like it gives the administrative side a chance to hire somebody at a little bit higher wage if they have the experience to go with it when they're new. So I can really appreciate that. I wish I had that when I was working with hiring people in the past. And so I think this looks like a pretty good program. Obviously, it stinks to hit the budget with more money, but I understand that's just the way it goes with minimum wage going up, we're all kind of having to stay ahead of it. Nobody wants to end up realizing that they just caught up with minimum wage because they stayed someplace too long. That's my two cents.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay. All right. Looks like we will be bringing this back to you then next week on the 14th. All right. Thank you. Okay. Moving along, we will go with item number 3 on our agenda items, and that is the 2022 Budget Amendment Ordinance 2030-22. This is a first read, and Kelly.
Good evening. Can you guys hear me okay? I don't know about this mic. All right, so the current budget for 2022 is presented with beginning cash plus expenditures, which you would have seen in previous ordinances. We made a little bit of change up. For me, that's not intuitive to look at numbers like that. So going forward, we've broken it out so you can see the difference between beginning cash and expenditures. Just asking for approval for some changes in 2022 expenditures. Some of the big ones include money transfers are also included in expenditures. So transferring our ARPA money out of our general fund and putting it into a ARPA designated fund so we can easily track that money, as well as the 1406 affordable housing money, transferring that out of the general fund, putting it into a designated fund, and setting up the appropriate expenditures in those funds. So attached, it again is the beginning cash and expenditures for each of our funds. I know there's a lot of them. And then a couple of notes on some of the significant changes in each of the funds.
Okay, thank you, Kelly. Are there any questions for Kelly? Okay, again, this is a first read, so go ahead, Mr. Allen.
I just love spreadsheets, so no questions.
All right. We'll bring this back next Wednesday as well. Thank you, Kelly. Fourth item on the list is the Central Skagit Library Memorandum of Understanding. This, too, is a first read. And we are Kelly. Yes.
Still here. So the city partnered with Central Skagit Library Districts for construction of the new district library. A large portion of the construction costs were funded by a bond proceed, but a smaller portion was funded pre-design work by the city, 41%, and the district, 59%. As of March of 2022, construction is complete and the final retainage payment was made. The city and the district agree that the remaining balance in that fund, the $295,000, should be split with that 59% contribution of the remaining money. So this would just be giving authorization to sign the agreement. We could bring this back for second read on the 14th, but if you're inclined to take action on it tonight, we could get these funds out by the end of the year, and we could close out the library the library construction fund the end of this year, and we wouldn't have to bring it back in 2023 and continue to track activity in that fund.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Do we have a motion?
I'll make that motion.
Thank you.
I'll second that.
Thank you. So we have a motion by Councilman McGoffin, seconded by Councilman Allen, to approve Mayor Johnson to sign the Memorandum of Understanding with the Central Skagit Library District. Any discussion or questions? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. All right. Fantastic. Thank you.
Yep.
All right, last item of the night is Ordinance 2029-22. It's the Historic Preservation First Read. Mr. Bush.
Thank you, Mayor Johnson. Okay, so this item may be a bit of a wow, look at that kind of item for all of you. So a little bit of background. I'll keep it as brief as I can, but we've had some discussion at the Business Development Committee, not a lot of formal discussion, just a little bit of discussion about economic development and the connection to history and the community. We've had a teeny bit of that discussion at council as well. Definitely not enough where we would normally bring you an item for action. However, we also had the owners of a property on Ferry Street who came to council recently, and it approached a lot of the staff and the mayor as well.
And are here again tonight.
Yes,
thank you.
Yes. Here. Sorry, I knew they were back there somewhere. I definitely don't have eyes in the back of my head. It's clear today. But yeah, they are here tonight, and they've certainly approached us about the potential to get their property onto a historic register here in Cedar Woolley. It's a process to get there, and I think that's my one caution to the council is there's a lot here. This is a big step for the city if we decide to take it. You'd be creating a historic preservation commission. The real benefit of that, if you decide to do it at some point, is to create historic districts. Historic districts, and I listed a bunch of them in the agenda materials, they have some real benefits for economic development, as does a Main Street program. A historic district, every property in that district would be protected, but it also creates additional permitting burdens for those properties. So there's a lot to consider with that. The way I've written the ordinance up, and John Coleman's here as well, and John and I have tag team on this a bit. Nikki is probably coming on at any moment, and she's also been working on this with us. But planning and building would be responsible for actual support of this and for support of the commission. But there's a whole process of inventorying historic properties in the community, and this all follows the state's model ordinance that we worked on. And then we would set up tonight or whenever you decide to take action, should you would set up a historic preservation commission. Their job would be to inventory properties. Their job would be to consider the kinds of requests like the ones that if you create this, we would get from the folks on Ferry Street to put their property on the historic register. There are criteria for that. We've taken a broad perspective in the ordinance that we wrote up to really look at all the possibilities, and the thought is then that will get whittled down over time as we as a community kind of figure out exactly where it is we want to really focus. But for now, it's pretty broad. I don't think we're going to see the floodgates of people coming in to have their properties designated necessarily open, so we'll have some time to work on this. But we would need to act relatively quickly if we want to meet the requests we've received. And so the recommendation is that the council would approve an ordinance, would amend the code. That would establish the Historic Preservation Commission, but temporarily it would be the Planning Commission because there's no way you can get a commission up and running super fast. So the Planning Commission would hear the request that we're expecting from the folks on Ferry Street at their meeting on December 20th. And then going forward, the Historic Preservation Commission would have to be appointed. So there's a process for that, of course. And then they would get to work on doing their thing. I sent out, and it was a long listen. I don't know if anybody actually took the time, but I sent out a video from a University of Pennsylvania professor who's an expert in the economics of historic preservation, which is a super niche field, but it's really pretty interesting. And one of the things he mentioned is the Main Street program is one of the absolute best returns on investment that any community can realize for historic preservation as it ties to economic development. So I think that's something for us to talk about down the road as we have more time. There's also some reference in the ordinance to what's called a certified local government, and that's a whole different level. And the ordinance aspires for us to become that, but if we were to get there, we would get additional grant money, additional training. I've acknowledged staff training in this document as well, as has John, and collaborating with me. That would be a key part of this. We don't have staff right now who are necessarily trained experts in historic preservation. That's a whole subfield of building and planning. But we would certainly work in that direction. The real policy question for council is, do you want to go down this road? Do you want to embrace historic preservation? It is in the comp plan, and there were a bunch of references to comp plan policies in here as well, that we would make a deeper commitment to historic preservation. But what exactly that looks like for the council is really up to all of you. So we've done our best to put something in front of you that you could act on. My only caution is it's often a risky thing to act on an item just for one request. So I just encourage you all to think broadly about the whole community, the future, other properties, all of that all together as you consider this policy.
With regards to the video, that was helpful and it was very informative. It's about 30, 40 minutes long, as I recall. You sent it out quite a while ago. I would encourage you to go back and find it if you can on your laptop. And I think it would be helpful in kind of framing what we're looking to do here. So,
yeah, I put it in the weekly update last week as well, so it's back in. Okay. You can find it easily that way.
Okay. All right. Any comments, questions? Yes, Ms. Keston.
Well, I want to thank you guys for all of your hard work in saving a piece of our history and preserving it for generations to come. And although I hear your caution, I'm very much for moving forward with this to help them as well as others who want to save our history as well. So thank you.
Mr. Allen?
This is family history. I think my dad might have been born in that hospital. The Condi clock, he's been here since 1900, is still in our family. My grandpa moved here like in 1912. So we have a lot of family history, and I think the tradition, it's even going back to the last issue. Cedral Woolley does things the Cedral Woolley way. Whether it works or not, it always has worked. And so anyway, I really think anyone that wants to step up, I don't see where the state law, according to what I read in your memo, does not require an architect and a builder and a bricklayer or anything. I think we're just creating we're trying to impede what they're trying to do is what I think. And, on caution, but I don't think it's warranted. I think what they're proposing is very well validated. So anyway, that's my thought.
Thank you. Anyone else? Councilman Owens?
Yeah, I want to thank SALPS for inviting us to tour their home, and it was really fascinating. I was just carried away with it, but it's old and it's original inside. There's nothing been done fancy. It's just a beautiful home. There's a lot of history in there, and when I got to the electrical panel, that just floored me. I mean, the old original panel, he's got it in a glass case there, and every room is, the beds and, whatever. But it's a good tour, and the people that didn't show up and go through it, I'm sure Mr. Salp would let you come in and go through the house. And I'm going to come and take my wife. She wasn't feeling well, so I'm going to bring her and go through your house. I'll try not to come at dinner time.
Yeah, I do hear what the council is actually saying, and that it is our history here, and it does make us feel more rooted and connected with our community when we have these kinds of preservations that are happening within our city. So I think this is a good conversation to have, and I think we can move forward with this, perhaps. More conversation, perhaps, with this. Do you want to take this to a different committee? Yes, Councilman Lavaca.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you see my hand up or if I want to say. So I was just going to say I would love to see the SAP's request met. I didn't get a chance to get over to the house, but I do understand about it. And I got a history over in Port Townsend and on Glendale Farm and historical properties that are just amazing at hundreds of years or over 100 years old and remodeling them. I just don't feel comfortable tying this all up in the same thing. And my question is there a way to approve their request without overburdening with all of this right now and coming back to looking at this historical commission? Is there a way for the Planning Commission to work on their request? I was going to ask that at our last meeting, and it's something that I feel that we probably could do, if possible, and not tie it together.
So I see I see that our city attorney has joined us as well, and she may want to chime in on this, but in our conversations, there is not a way to make this designation in a legal manner without actually designating a historic preservation commission. So the council would need to take some action to amend the code to establish that, and then this particular ordinance would actually appoint the planning commission, and then they could consider the matter with the SAP's property.
Madam Mayor, yes. Just one last question. How much problem do the ADUs create for the city? The units?
The mother-in-law's?
What is it?
Accessory dwelling units? Is that what you're talking about? The ADUs?
Yeah. Do they create a problem for us or not when we enacted all that?
I'm not tracking how this has to do with...
I'm just saying if we adopt something to have historical and, you know, I mean, I'm just saying ADUs, how many people applied for them in the last couple of years? It hasn't overwhelmed the city, right?
No, but we did have to go through the Planning Commission. We did have to go through steps in order to make that happen. We had to have a public hearing. And so we are obligated, if we want to do this correctly, to follow the RCW to the best of our ability.
Okay.
So that's what we're looking at here. I hear you, Glenn. I wish it just could be simple. We could say, yes, this is the way it is. But for some people, and in particular for both Gene and Terry, if we had this in place, it could have meant a tax break, as I understand it. It would have been financially, for all the work and the money that they've put into their home, they would have been able to.
I kind of felt like the state historical had already okayed all of this to occur.
Well, you did receive a state, but what they're looking at is to have it here within our city.
Actually, no.
No?
What we're asking for is the final step in the process that would allow us to have the special tax valuation. And
what is a tax evaluation?
That
okay.
process began with getting the State Heritage Registry approved, then submitting an application to the county assessor. It's a Department of Revenue form that's sent to the county assessor. He verified the original market value of the home. And that dollar amount is what is used as the basis for the 10 years of property tax valuation. My reading, and I'm not a lawyer, so wherever she is that there needs to be a local review board that approves the application for the special tax valuation. Skagit County doesn't have a special review board. The county assessor sent he doesn't approve the application for the special tax valuation, but he acknowledges the form was complete and what the market value was at the time of purchase, which was 2019. He sent that information to the county commissioners, and somewhere here in the city of Cedar Woolley, I don't know, actually got that letter, and said there is no review board, local review board, either in the city or in the county. And so what we were hoping for, and I realize it may be naive, because this has to be approved by December 31st, has to happen in the same calendar year as when you get on the State Heritage Registry and you've completed the Department of Revenue form and submitted it to the county assessor, that somehow there could be a local review board that would just simply review the application that we've already submitted to the county assessor.
All right, thank you. Mr. Lavaca, I see your hand up.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. So I believe that this is that what they're asking is not historical for our city, although it would be good to pursue that for our city, I think, at some point, but just something where our planning commission can review it for, like, basically what we're doing for the senior housing hold on the property tax increase, right? So they're looking at a property tax basic baseline from 2018, so it's not included in their 2019 or their current value of their home after the remodel, because it would be significantly higher, and hold it for 10 years. So it's not necessarily putting it into a historic registry in our community, which I think is value added to our community, and we should pursue that. But would there be a way to get our planning commission to review the current property value and the property value that was before and the paperwork they have, so they can get their thing by the 31st? On their 20th meeting, maybe they can look at it. Is that too short?
It's not too short. That was the plan all along. But in order to actually create the local review board, which is the Historic Preservation Commission, you've got to pass the ordinance to do that. And that's what we've prepared for you in short order.
So does the Historic Review Commission change the permitting status for any residents in Cedar Woolley, I guess? Will it add additional burdens on them for remodels or property values, or does it affect the resident themselves at any level, unless they want it, unless they apply for it?
Exactly. Only if a property is on the historic register and they have to sign on to that. The exception to that is if the city were to create, or the commission, the way I've written it up, were to create a historic district. In that case, a simple majority of the people in that district would have to agree to form that district. And then the other people who are in that area could be brought into that district. So there could be some opposition to that type of approach.
But it's still voted on by the people within that district. It wouldn't be the commission voting that in. It wouldn't be the planning commission or the historical commission to make that set. It would go to the people within that community, and a majority would make that basis.
Yes. Stand. Yeah, there would be a process in which, yes, people had to agree to it. But not every single person in a district.
Yeah, I would be for that. That puts it back to the people about what they want within their area. So I'm in favor, for sure.
I would add that I think we're probably a ways off from creating a district or having that discussion. Like, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to get to that point.
Yeah, but just like moving forward with the step that they're requesting us tonight, that even Joellen Custy proposed that she was in favor of. I was thinking that it would affect people's personal properties within a vote that we would have right now, but it doesn't sound like that's the case at all. So it would kill two birds with one stone, basically, and it kind of pushes us in a direction that would benefit the community.
Madam Mayor?
Yes, yes.
After reading Section 7, review and monitoring of properties for special property tax valuation, it looks like everything's covered here for what the SAPs are asking for. I have reservations anytime we're adding a burden to property owners, but everything in here seems to cover that, so that there's a democratic process to where people get to vote and decide if they even want to be in a historic district, if that should ever come. And I believe that from reading the state law, it really feels like this is the right thing for us to do, because we're meeting the obligation expected by the state in order to help residents who are preserving our history. I'm a big fan of preserving historic homes and just kind of trying to hang on to our history in general. So I think this is a really good process to put in place. I especially like that you found a workaround so that the Planning Commission can take care of the current matter at hand, but then setting up a long-term system so that when people do approach us in the future, we have something laid out in stone to follow. Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Just so I understand this correctly, by approving this, we could open the avenue where they could get their approval this year. In addition to, we can take it at our own pace after that so that we can set it up properly, have time to think about it, but it's been approved. So, like, we don't need to set it all up and get historic districts moving 2023. It's just, we have the ability to start looking into it, correct?
Yeah, historic districts are kind of a whole future discussion that may or may not occur. But right now it's written up so the commission would actually engage in that and make those decisions. So that's something we could always come back and change the code too if the council wanted to do that. That could come to the council ultimately if you wanted that to occur. That's an option as well. But yeah, right now you're just setting it up. It's possible that there could be more applications that come in the future from other people who have done this kind of work on their property. possibly next year. I don't know of any right now, but it's possible that could occur. Those would go to the Planning Commission if the Historic Preservation Commission were not established yet. But I think it's incumbent upon us as staff to get working on creating a Historic Preservation Commission in 2023. So that's one of the items we'd take on.
Yes, thank you very much for working really hard to get this all set up for us. And I'd like to make a motion to move forward and approve.
I'd like to second that.
All right, thank you. So we have a motion by Councilwoman Kesty and seconded by Councilman Burns to move forward with the historic preservation, especially as it is appropriate for the economic development strategy of Cedar Woolley. Any more discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Okay. Got our work cut out for us. Lots of conversation.
Mayor.
On that one. Yes.
If I could make sure that we clarify on the record that that was actually a motion to adopt Ordinance 2029-22.
Oh, my apologies. Yes, I see it right here. Yes, it is at the very top of the page. Ordinance 2029-22, Historic Preservation. The council has approved unanimously to approve that ordinance. There we go. How's that? Stumbled all over that.
Thank you.
There it is. Thank you. Okay, and with that, congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
And with that, we are adjourned. However, council, we will be moving into closed session for discussion of collective bargaining. So thank you, everybody, for coming tonight. Yes, and thank you again for opening up your home. It is a beautiful home. It was fun to see it both prior to your having the furniture in it and then putting the furniture and the beautiful items in it. That really completed the picture. So thank you. Yeah. It's very cool. Yeah. And the operating room. All right. You guys have a happy holiday. All right, everyone. We're going to move into the lunchroom over there. I'm not sure which collective bargaining it is. It may be both of them, so let me see.
Okay, yep.
Oh, same as last time then.
Yep, two-part.
Does anybody want this? Because it will be, I mean, you have it in your folder, but it actually, or in your packet, but it may answer questions that you may have regarding the salary commission. Not the salary commission, the salaries. Okay. John.